Good evening, boxing fans. This is the Rattlegym Broadcasting Network trip through heavyweight boxing. Championship heavyweight boxing, that is. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight is Chapter 3 in our long, strange look at the heavyweight lineal heavyweight champions. We are looking at the life and career of Boxing Hall of Famer Joe Louis. Joining me tonight, as he has for our previous two chapters, and will continue to do so as we go down this winding road, is the punchy pugilist. Tonight, he's just not everywhere you look. He is Pat Mullen. How do you do, sir?
And I would like to let everyone know that tonight is sponsored by Labatt's Blue Light. When you want to drink Canadian, but you still want to feel American, Labatt's Blue Light.
That's very good. People should have paid us for that. I like my Guinness. That's what I like. I don't drink it a lot, but if I have to drink beer, I like to drink a nice thick stout.
Well, speaking of dark, thick, and stout, we've got a fascinating subject for you tonight.
Perfect. Yes. Joe Louis, the Brown Bomber. He was born May 13th, 1914, in Lafayette, Alabama. And he became heavyweight champion when he defeated the Cinderella Man, James Braddock, June 22nd, 1937. And according to the wiki, he had the longest single reign. How about that, Pat?
11 years and 10 months unbroken as the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, a mark I don't know that we will ever see accomplished again. And it's just one of the many things that separate Louis from so many others who followed him and came before him. Interesting of note, we've talked about the title changes that have gone on, and obviously we spend a little more time on the more iconic and long-reigning champions of the eras. So Braddock had won his title, as I'm sure most people listening to this have seen, against Max Baer, as is immortalized in the film Cinderella Man, starring Russell Crowe as Jim Braddock. So Joe Louis is the hottest heavyweight prospect going. He's unbelievable. He is trained by Jack Blackburn, who is an alcoholic but knows the fight game well and is basically told to show this kid how to fight because he looks like he could be something. And Louis just tears through the heavyweight ranks. He's beating former champions like Jack Sharkey and Primo Carnera. And he gets matched up with a guy we've spoken about before on this show, Max Schmeling. And Schmeling is considered past his best, but still a viable, good heavyweight who's going to test Louis. And reporters say to Schmeling, you know, what are you doing? You're getting in there with this kid who's destroying everybody. How are you going to fight him? And Schmeling has one line to answer all of them about it, and he says, "I see something," in his German accent. And what Schmeling saw was Louis's tendency that when he didn't double jab, when he just threw a single jab, he brought it back low. And Schmeling, whose best punch was his overhand right, thought that if he could get close enough to Louis to drop that single jab and he could get his right hand in, he could hurt Louis and stop him. And in fact, that's what happens. In the fourth round of their fight, he finally is able to close that opening and hurts Louis very badly with that right hand and drops him. And the fight continues up until the 12th round when Schmeling finally stops Louis. At that point in time, Schmeling becomes the number one contender to the heavyweight championship and is realistically who Jimmy Braddock should be fighting. Instead, Louis's team, Jim Jacobs and his management staff negotiate that Louis is going to still get the shot at Braddock, but Louis is going to give Braddock 10% of his future earnings. That's important come later on. The other part of it is that the world is very politicized at this point with the rise of some guy in Germany named Hitler. And it's thought to be a very bad thing if a German is able to fight for, not only fight for, but potentially win the heavyweight championship of the world. So this deal gets made, and Louis instead gets the shot at Braddock. And in the first round, Braddock drops Lewis with a short little right hand inside. The difference between this and Schmeling is Braddock wasn't a terribly great puncher the way Schmeling was, and Lewis was more embarrassed than anything. And he gets up and basically beats on Braddock for the next seven rounds until it's finally stopped in the eighth, and thus begins the longest uninterrupted reign of any heavyweight champion in history.
The next, once he has won the title by eighth round KO, he'll fight Tommy Farr to a unanimous decision in 15 rounds in Yankee Stadium. He then goes on to KO Nathan Mann in the third round and Harry Thomas in the fifth round. Now, this next fight is the first, since his title reign has begun, his first major plot point in the career of Joe Lewis. Because up to this point, Joe Lewis has one loss on his record. At the time of this fight, he is 35-1. And who is that 1-2? Nazi fighter Max Schmeling. And so this is the rematch. Max Schmeling is competing for the heavyweight championship of the world. This, folks, and what's really funny about this is that, get out your bingo cards because I'm going to make a wrestling reference. People get on professional wrestling for the foreign heel stereotypes, you know, the jingoism in the storytelling. But this is as real as it gets. And even here, you had America versus Germany. The America versus the Nazis. These guys are two guys having a competitive fight for the heavyweight championship of the world. But the narrative is it's America versus the Nazis in the squared circle.
And let's look at the competitors and their backgrounds to their respective countries at this point. Joe Lewis, for those who don't know, was black. Now, he also had some shared Cherokee and white ancestry, but Joe Lewis is a black man, okay? At this point in time, he can't use the same water fountains and parks. There are segregated restaurants, buses, all the like. Yet, he's being looked to at this point in time as America's hope against Nazi domination. Schmeling, who's from Germany and has been brought in to have audience with Adolf Hitler, is not pro-Nazi. He is just a very good heavyweight prize fighter who happens to be from the country that is now occupied by the National Socialist Party of Germany, also known as the Nazi Party. During the events of the Nazi takeover and Hitler's reign, Schmeling actually harbored Jews, helped them get out of Germany, and is not on board with what's going on. Yet, the narrative being presented to everybody by the media, by literally everybody, is that this is America versus Germany from two guys who really didn't represent either country in reality.
It's marketing and jingoism can be a funny thing at times. But let's talk about the fight itself. It's not long. It's a first round KO by Joe Lewis over Max Schmeling on June 22nd, 1938, in where? Bronx Bombers, baby, Yankee Stadium. 2 minutes and 4 seconds into the first round, boom goes the dynamite. Let's take a moment here and talk about what made Joe Lewis great going into the Max Schmeling fight.
Well, it wasn't the phone call from FDR before the fight. Though that did happen, and I'm sure added the fuel to the fire. Joe Lewis was, you know, Customato once said of him when educating young Mike Tyson, Joe Lewis may have been quiet on the outside, but he was pure rage on the inside because he was a black man in a white man's world and he hated it. Joe Lewis is probably the first guy we look at who really had an alter ego in the ring. That was different. You know, the Brown Bomber and Joe Lewis are two different people. Joe Lewis on the outside of the ring liked to gallivant around with women in private. He liked to play a lot of golf. He, you know, was generally an affable, pretty easygoing guy. on the inside in the ring, the Brown Bomber took over. And he was devastation from the moment the bell rang.
Hang on. It's important to know that people still have memories of Jack Johnson during the Joe Louis era. And the people around Joe Louis made it a point to say, if you want white America to love you when their knee-jerk reaction is to not love you, play their game. Be their boy.
And there were rules he had to follow based on that. Joe Louis could not have his picture taken alone with a white woman. There had to be somebody else present. Joe Louis could not be pictured eating his favorite food, which is watermelon, because they did not want to present the possibility of a negative stereotype and embrace it. He was not allowed to gloat or celebrate over a fallen white opponent. He was to just simply walk back to the corner and not be excitable or exaggerated or obnoxious in that respect. He was a very much as he was trained in how to fight and be disciplined, they extended that to his public image.
And so, going into Louis versus Schmeling, round two. In the first round, and the first time they fought, the very first loss that Joe Louis would have on his professional record, also in Yankee Stadium, by the way, 2 years prior, 1936, Joe Louis was KO'd in the 12th round out of 15. So, Pat, from Max Schmeling 1 to Max Schmeling 2, what did Joe Louis learn that made him so successful in this fight against Max Schmeling that he would knock him out in the first round?
Well, the biggest factor is, like we talked about, Louis had this tendency of dropping his left hand after a single jab while still being in punching range and setting himself up to be hit with a good right-hand counter. That's not present this time. But we talk about the political scope of this fight, everything that's happening. That's clearly a motivational factor going into this for Louis. There's that part of it. There's the embarrassment part of it. And, you know, of all the heavyweights we've covered, every one of them at a certain point has lost before they get to the heavyweight championship. And a lot of what we'll talk about is that those losses early in a career help refine a guy and make them better. Because usually your mettle is not really tested until you've lost a fight, and we see how you respond to that. In Louis's case, the biggest thing that had him was a technical flaw. Wasn't for lack of a chin or he, you know, had a stamina problem or anything of the kind. It was just one little technical hitch that cost him against Schmeling. It's not there this time. On top of that, like we talked about, in the first fight they had 2 years prior, Schmeling is thought to be a bit past his prime at that point in time. He had actually received a horrific beating from Max Baer, who showed up motivated to their fight over 10 rounds and really just took a tremendous amount of punishment and was thought to, at that point, kind of be damaged goods going forward. And that's why the win over Louis was such an upset.
About 7 months later, he'll take on John Henry Louis and knock him out in the first round in Madison Square Garden. A few months after that, he'll fight Jack Roper in Wrigley Field, Los Angeles, and knock him out in the first round. Which brings us to our next big point in Joe Louis's career. Now, part of it, when we first started this, we talked about the look of the modern heavyweight. These are some big dudes. Deontay Wilder is like 6'5", 6'6", something like that. He is a tall drink of water. And he's wide and he's built, very muscular. He looks like a professional fighter. Tyson Fury is like a walking building. He's huge. And while not as muscular, he is certainly a solid man and not somebody you would really want to pick a fight with. Back in 1939, my spirit animal, Tony Galento, challenged Joe Louis for the heavyweight championship of the world. If you don't know who Tony Galento is, Tony Galento looks like a cartoon mob boss, okay? Tony Galento was born March 12, 1910. He was nicknamed Two-Ton for his reasoning to his manager for being nearly late to one of his fights. "I had 2 tons of ice to deliver on my way here," quote unquote. Galento, as the story goes, was one of the most colorful fighters in the history of the sport. Ladies and gentlemen, Tony Galento, my spirit animal, wrestled an octopus. He boxed a kangaroo. Okay? This is the kind of thing Tony Galento did. A terror to the animal kingdom far and wide. An octopus. A kangaroo. Yes, there was such thing as a boxing kangaroo.
And that's when he wasn't tending bar in West Orange, New Jersey at his saloon.
He also boxed a 550-pound bear as a stage attraction. This man is maybe an inch or two taller than me. Okay, he's listed as 5'9". Pat, can you imagine a 5'9 guy today fighting the heavyweight championship of the world in professional boxing? I'll answer for you. You can't. Galento was a no-holds-barred brawler. He had a wicked left hook. And he never let such niceties as ring rules or sportsmanship interfere with his goal to knock the other fighter out. This guy, I have a great love and affection for modern bare-knuckle fighting, and it harkens back to the days of Tony Galento, who, if you can just picture cartoon boxing in your head, this guy was the master.
He looks like a character who would have been in Punch-Out.
He really does.
And historically, he's probably one of the 10 dirtiest fighters that there's ever been.
How did nobody produce a movie about this guy's life starring Danny DeVito?
That's a fair question. Because he is one of the great characters of all time. You know, Galento gets the fight with Louis. And they ask him, you know, "So what do you think your chances are against Joe Louis?" And he goes, "Who?" And they go, "Joe Louis, the heavyweight champion of the world." And he said, "Never heard of a bum." In his Jersey accent. His training methods are legendary. Eating beer, or eating hot dogs and drinking beer, and going to do his road work at 2 a.m. because he fought at night, and that's when he closed his bar. But he was such a character that there were little things that he would do that were just so odd. Like, Max Baer once described him, when he fought him, as smelling like bad tuna fish and old liquor being sweated out through his pores.
Perfect.
Because hygiene wasn't important to him, because he thought it would be a distraction to his opponent. And he was probably right. But at what cost, Tony? He's also, like we talked about, one of the 10 dirtiest fighters of all time. He had a fight with Lou Nova, and Galento was warned for the following. Knees. Yes, he threw knees in a heavyweight fight. Headbutting, which is not super uncommon. It is when you do it multiple times. Gouging, which nobody does anymore. But in that time when you had thumbs on the gloves that were not attached to the gloves, as well as laces, you could gouge pretty easy. Hitting below the belt, and hitting Nova when he was down twice, and that doesn't even count with them clinching and allegedly falling, when in reality, Galento hit a waistlock takedown and drove his knees into Nova's ribs.
This guy has the dubious honor of having fought and beaten on June 21st, 1943, Classy Freddie Blassie, which is also his one and only fight before he switched to wrestling. He knocked him out in the second round. By the time he finally got to Joe Louis is going to be his last fight. at this point, he's like 78-24-5. And with this loss, he'll be 24-6. 78-24-6. This is not a technical masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination. But our hero...
ugly.
But our hero, Tony Galento, old windmill puncher himself, has the dubious honor and distinction of having knocked down Joe Louis for the first time in... if I'm reading this right, Galento knocked down Joe Louis in round two for the first time in his career. He knocked the champ down for a two count in round three. This guy who has the body shape of Q-bert. Okay, I don't know if all the kids are going to get that reference. Look it up. It's a ball with feet. This guy with the physique of a bowling ball knocked the heavyweight championship, that knocked the heavyweight champion of the world down in not one but two rounds. But the fight continued. Joe Louis persevered. And in round four, he finally won. He won the fight. But oh boy, can you imagine? Can you imagine, you know, like me, knocking down Deontay Wilder? First of all, I think people would just, you know, they'd start setting the arena on fire.
Well, here's the thing with that. Whatever you want to say about Galento, Galento has two factors going for him. He was very, very tough, and he hit very, very hard. Those two things will always get you to a certain level. Louis and Galento did a show together years later that Kurt Gowdy hosted called The Way It Was, where they would take a look at a past sporting event. And the usually very reserved Louis, even in retirement, said of Galento at the point where he knocked him down, he goes, "That made me mad. And I didn't really like care for his attitude, and I wanted to hurt him."
This is the one where I think Joe Louis tried to carry him, didn't he?
He was gonna play with him and put on a show, and then Galento went ahead and just cracked him as hard as he could and dropped him. And at that point, Louis's attitude became, okay, playtime is over. Not unlike what we saw from Jack Johnson and Stanley Ketchel.
The other really funny thing about Tony Galento before we move on, and really, if you haven't heard of Tony Galento and you're only hearing about him for the first time, if I haven't teased you, if I haven't got your attention with this man's exploits over the animal kingdom and such, please go look him up. Go look up his fights, so you know, the ones that you can find on YouTube or whatever. This guy's amazing. Years later, Jackie Gleason would tell a story about Tony Galento. So Jackie Gleason's doing a show, and there's this loudmouth in the audience, and every time Jackie Gleason starts to get into a groove, this loudmouth guy keeps heckling him. And they go back and forth and back and forth, and finally Gleason says, "Look, I've had enough of you. Let's go talk about this outside." And Jackie Gleason turns around. They go outside. He turns around, faces this heckling gentleman, and he says, "Now look, you," probably before he even got to "you," it was lights out. Because that heckler is our hero, Tony Galento.
And, yeah, Gleason would talk about this later, and years later, about how he had no idea what he got himself into. And, you know, Gleason wasn't exactly a pushover. He was a large man, both in weight and stature, and had fought a lot when he was a kid, and he was not somebody who was going to back down. And the next thing he remembers is waking up in the cellar. Galento only hit him one time, but that's all he needed. And if that don't tell you everything you need to know about Tony Galento, I don't know what else will. But, yeah, you know, for all the talk of, like we said, Galento and his habits and all this, he was at the time rated the number two heavyweight in the world. And again, he had 78 wins on his record. he beat a lot of name guys at the time through his combination of just sheer toughness and punching power. Unfortunately for him, he's fighting one of the very best heavyweights that there's ever been, and a guy considered by many at that time to be the perfect fighting machine. And even dropping him, still not enough.
Such is the mettle of Joe Lewis. He'll fight Bill Pastor next and knock him out in the 11th round in September of 1939. But our next story takes us to a pair of fights. He'll win both, but how he got there is the story. He fights Arturo Godoy to a split decision in February 9th of 1940 in Madison Square Garden. He then takes a brief reprieve to fight Johnny Paycheck and get a TKO victory just a month later. And then in June of that year, his third fight in the year 1940 in Yankee Stadium, back to good old Yankee Stadium, is the rematch with Arturo Godoy. Now, what's so special about the split decision and then this TKO victory? Why is this important in the life and times and career of Joe Lewis, Pat?
Well, if Lewis had a problem with any one particular fighter, it was thinking man's fighters who could adjust and box and move and not engage him toe-to-toe. So we go back to Lewis's first defense against the Welshman Tommy Farr, which is probably the most difficult defense he had to a certain point. But ever since then, he's been on this wrecking path of just destroying guys left and right. Godoy fought Lewis on Lewis's terms. He didn't run from him. He didn't try to be cute and box. He went right at Lewis. And while he didn't win, he won over a lot of people. And the thing about that is, it's one of those fights where just because a guy isn't getting destroyed, people tend to give him more credit than he should be getting. That being said, Godoy was a huge hero in his native South America. He's from Chile. And they were all crying foul that he was not scheduled to, that he was not scored the winner in their fight. Now, at that point in time, fights are scored by two judges and the referee. The referee gave the fight to Lewis to break the judge's tie. And people were just so amazed that Godoy lasted the distance and took the fight to Lewis at points. And it was decided that a rematch was necessary. And kind of almost like you see with Schmeling, whenever there's doubt, this is where Lewis responds. And he invokes the Brown Bomber persona again. And, you know, a lot of people like Teddy Atlas will say, we don't really know a fighter until they've faced adversity. And this is where Lewis tends to shine, is his rematches, maybe more than anything. And this would be a shining example.
So as I said, in the rematch, he gets a TKO victory in the 8th round of 15. He'll have one more fight to close out 1940, December 16th against Al McCoy. After that, he fights pretty regularly throughout 1941. He has a lot of fights. I mean, he's fighting almost every month here. He knocks
and
out.
This is when we get the what's been come to be known, whether fair or unfair, as the Bum of the Month Club.
Yeah, this is that sequence in Rocky III where Rocky's defending the title.
Basically, yeah. And a side note: one of the great trainers of all time, Ray Arcel. He ends up cornering quite a few of the guys who oppose Lewis for the title. And because of the nature of their fortunes against Lewis, Arcel is given the nickname in the press, The Undertaker.
So, yes, Red Berman KO'd in the 5th round. That's January of 1941. A few short weeks later, on February 17th, he knocks out Gus D'Orazio in the 2nd round. The following month, almost a month to the day later, he TKOs Abe Simpson, who was yelling at clouds at the time and wearing an onion on his belt, such was the style. Abe Simon is TKO'd in the 13th round. The following month, He TKOs Tony Musto, who are now into April, in the ninth round. And then here's a fun one. I don't know if you know anything about this, Pat. If you can give any insight here. There's a brief note on this. He fights Buddy Bear in Griffith Stadium, Washington, D.C., May 23rd, 1941.
Who is, in fact, the brother of Max Bear.
And this actually ends in a DQ. No, not with a chair to the head or anything, you know, like that. But Bear's disqualified because his manager refused to leave the ring. Okay?
So, Bear had actually put on a really good performance to this point. He through six rounds, he actually leads on the official scorecards. However, in the sixth round, Lewis had basically taken his measure and really started to do a paint job on him and beat him up and hurt him. Bear's manager is obviously very keenly aware of this, and so he, in his infinite wisdom, tries to buy time between the sixth and seventh round so that Buddy can recover. The referee catches on to this and is like, this shit ain't happening on my watch. This is a disqualification because your second is in the ring while the fight should be happening. It's twofold in that, one, if he's able to buy Buddy time, then maybe Buddy can go on and fight his best fight as he's been doing. But he also knows that, well, if Buddy loses by a disqualification, nobody's really happy with that. And he was winning the fight up until this point, so maybe we can get a fight later on.
Which is exactly what happened. Next year, he'll fight Buddy Bear January 9th, 1942 in Madison Square Garden. And much ado about nothing, KO'd in the first round. But that's not the story here. The story next, on our next chapter on Joe Lewis, is Billy Kahn. Let's talk about Billy Kahn for a minute, Pat. Tell the people, who is Billy Kahn and why does this matter?
Billy Kahn was a tough Irish kid from Pittsburgh who started out his career as a middleweight and eventually fought his way up to being the light heavyweight champion of the world. And Billy is just a very tricky, clever fighter who is fast-handed, uses beautiful movement, and over the course of his last 10 fights prior to Joe Lewis, has developed something he didn't have early in his career, which is knockout power. Kahn is not thought of as a tremendous puncher historically, because in his 64 career wins, he's only got 15 knockouts. But that's because he relied so heavily on his boxing ability early on that when he found himself at light heavyweight and fighting for the title, he didn't want to give it up. So he started really putting some mustard on his punches, and he's stopping guys and dropping guys. And Kahn is, at this point, thought of as one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the game. Lewis is destroying everybody in the heavyweight division. So, as has been custom in the past from guys like George Carpentier, Kahn is going to test his mettle and move up to heavyweight and challenge for the title. And to do it, they actually, which was not commonly done at the time, they make him relinquish the light heavyweight championship, mainly due to the fact that it's World War II on the way, and American intervention is not there yet, but there's the potential, and they don't want to have titles frozen for any length of time.
So he KOs Billy Kahn in the 13th round and then closes out 1941 in September against Lou Nova with a six-round TKO. We have a rematch with Buddy Bear in 1942. We're back to Abe Simon in Madison Square Garden with his six-round TKO March 27th of 1942. There's a bit of inactivity between 1942 and 1944.
Yeah, there's this thing called World War II.
Yes, indeed. I believe Joe Lewis served. I forget what the details were on that.
Well, he was actually promoted to the rank of sergeant, and a lot of what Lewis did was physical instruction. He would box exhibitions for servicemen at their camps, and in truth, that's where a lot of the rift came between him and years later, which we'll get to when we talk about Cassius Clay, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali. We'll talk a little bit about why Lewis and he had a rift that developed between them, largely based on war service. And at the time, Lewis really kind of uses a little bit of his weight in his standing as heavyweight champion, because Lewis serves in a segregated cavalry unit when he goes to basic training, and there's a lot of things that go on, and he is at one point sent to box an exhibition, but the black troops are not allowed to watch. Lewis says, they don't get to watch, then we're not having it. And he basically at that point took a brave stand, and it's not one that would have been common at the time. Another guy who was serving in World War II with Lewis is a guy who admired him as a youth, became a fighter in his own right, did pretty well for himself. He's a guy named Sugar Ray Robinson. And while Lewis and Robinson never were on the front lines, they weren't there, the racism was apparent during that time. And on one occasion, there's an incident where Lewis and Sugar Ray are at a bus depot, and they're told by one of the MPs to get to the back. Lewis said, we ain't moving. And suffice to say, there's a scuffle, and the guy walks away not as well as he walked into it. In another instance that Jackie Robinson talked about, Lewis once basically had to flex his muscle to get Jackie out of a situation because Jackie Robinson had punched somebody who called him the N-word. And because Lewis carried such weight, he was able to get Robinson out of being charged with anything or into any trouble. Now, we'll talk about Jackie Robinson for a second. Jackie Robinson is always looked at as the guy who really is the first black hero of sports and organized sports in the United States, who, you know, all these things happen. And Robinson is an incredible figure. He broke the baseball color barrier, incredible career as a second baseman with the Dodgers. But before there was Jackie Robinson, there was Joe Lewis. And Joe Lewis opened a lot of doors for a lot of people of color in this country before Jackie Robinson by about a good 10 years. And he doesn't often get credit for that. And that's as heavyweight champion of the world following these rules, but he created opportunity and unity where there wasn't before that.
So during this period, he has a fight that some say may have been an exhibition against Johnny Davis. That's 1944. Again, we have another year of service in the military and no boxing. But things pick up again June 19th in 1946 at Yankee Stadium. We have the rematch against Billy Kahn, and that ends in an 8-round KO. He'll close out the year September 18th, 1946, again at Yankee Stadium against Tammy Moriello with a first-round KO. Things start winding down here for our hero. He doesn't fight almost for a little more than a year after that. He has a split decision against Jersey Joe Walcott in Madison Square Garden on December 5th, 1947. 6 months later, they'll do the rematch, and he'll KO Jersey Joe in the 11th round. This is 1948, by the way.
Right, and he won the title in what year, Mark?
1937.
So, again, 11 years and 10 months he's been the heavyweight champion of the world. We kind of glossed over his series with Billy Kahn a little bit. In the first fight, I mentioned how Lewis had trouble with guys who could think and be on the move and create, for lack of a better word, while in a fight. Well, Kahn could do that. And to try to legitimize this fight in the eyes of the press, they exaggerated the weights. Lewis' reality weighed about 204, 205 pounds. Kahn probably weighed about 169 pounds. Their weights were given as 174 pounds and 199 pounds. In the fight, Kahn is really doing very well for himself with combinations, foot movement, and Lewis is having a hard time finding him. We get into the later stages of the fight in the 12th round. Kahn hits Lewis with this left hook that he never sees coming and really hurts him very bad. The legs buckle. He's paused for a minute and frozen, and Khan goes to work on him. In the 13th round, Khan would describe himself as, "I got Irish." And he tries to take Lewis out. The problem is Lewis is Lewis. And he goes and fights with him on the inside, and he gets hit with a punch he never sees coming and drops Khan for the count. So after World War II, they were actually supposed to box each other earlier than this, but it got postponed due to commitments for both of them in the war effort. They have the rematch, and Lewis is asked, "What are you going to do this time?" And there's a very famous quote that came out of this that people use all the time, but it's attributed to Joe Lewis before anybody else. When asked about his strategy, Lewis simply replied, "He can run, but he can't hide."
Mm.
And the second fight is really a bit of a walkover. Lewis kind of has his way for the majority of it, stops Khan in the eighth round. And afterward, you know, going back to their first fight, Khan and Lewis had become friends, and Khan said to him, "You couldn't let me have the heavyweight championship of the world, Joe, and just win it back for me?" And Lewis says, "Billy, I let you have it for 12 rounds, and you couldn't hold on to it."
Nice. Yes, so...
That brings us back to Jersey Joe.
Yes, sir.
And Joe had been a sparring partner of Lewis in years prior. And Lewis has gone through the fight, the rematch with Khan. You mentioned he knocked out Tammy Moriello in the first at Yankee Stadium. So he has this fight with Jersey Joe because Joe financially is struggling and needs a payday. He's looked at as a good but not spectacular fighter. And that's because a lot of times when Joe was training, he couldn't afford to eat. He had a bunch of kids he needed to support. He was really at that poverty line in Camden, New Jersey, which is still not great. I think things are still 1937 there in terms of finances and everything. And the one thing about Joe is that adversity made him great when he could get to it. Knowing the pay that he was going to get against Joe Lewis, he was able to train properly. He was able to do everything he needed to do. And going into that fight, again, the thinkers are the guys Joe Lewis struggled with. And Jersey Joe was a thinker. And he used every trick he knew in the book. He used his familiarity with Lewis to know what he needed to do against them. And he drops Lewis twice in this fight. One with a real sneaky right-hand counter off of what's called the cakewalk, which is almost like a side lateral walk where it seems like you're shifting away from your opponent, inviting them to come in, and you look to counter by whipping all your weight the opposite way with a punch. And that's what Jersey Joe first catches Joe Lewis with. And he drops him again later on in the fight. And this one, for those who've seen it, the full bout is not available in its entirety. But the stuff that is available, it certainly looks like Lewis got the benefit of the doubt from the judges in this one.
Which brings us to the night he lost the title for good, the one and only time he lost the title. He fights Ezzard Charles.
Well, it brings us there eventually, but there is the rematch with Walcott, and any doubts are answered in that. Like we talked about, Lewis is kind of king of the rematches and stops Walcott in the 11th.
Right. So he takes the next year off, year and a half. Well,
He essentially had retired at this point.
Okay.
And he kind of officially gave his note that, hey, you know, this was it for me after the second Walcott fight, because he felt at that point, as a fighter, you feel that point where, you know, it's not that I don't have it, it's that I don't have it like I needed it, is the best way to describe it. I'll always point to an instance where, like, Sugar Ray Leonard had fought Kevin Howard in a 1984 comeback, and he got knocked down in that fight and was embarrassed, and he wins, but at the end of it, he said, it just wasn't there tonight. And that's kind of how Lewis felt after the second Walcott fight. He did enough to win, but it wasn't there for him the way it was, so he retires at this point. During that time, the top two rated contenders are Walcott, who had given Lewis the two tough fights, and Ezzard Charles, who was, at the time, had been recognized as the best light heavyweight in the world, but was never able to secure a title fight. Charles is considered by a lot of people to be the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world at this point, but just has never been given the opportunity. He has beaten Archie Moore, who is considered by many the greatest light heavyweight champion. He's beaten him in four separate meetings. Do you know how many times Moore has beaten Charles?
How many?
Zilch. Nada. Zip. That's how good Ezra Charles was. So they match up Charles and Walcott for the vacant championship, and Charles goes on to win recognition by what is then known as the NBA. There's still some question over it because he didn't beat the man, and that man is Joe Louis, who had retired. Eventually, Louis develops some tax problems from the U.S. government, who claim that he owes them a lot of money in back taxes, which forced Joe to come out of his retirement and fight again. And the natural reaction is to have him fight the guy who is claiming to be the heavyweight champion of the world at this time, which is Charles. So he dusts off the trunks and gloves, comes back, and he loses a pretty clear decision to Charles. There's some moments of the old Brown Bomber in there, but they're very few and far between, and Charles does what he did best, which is put on a boxing clinic to kind of erase any doubt as to whether or not he's the real heavyweight champion of the world.
So here's the real sad story about all of this. The result was not the only disappointing aspect for the fight for Louis. Only 22,357 spectators paid to witness the event at Yankee Stadium, and his share of the purse was a mere $100,458. He owed the government more than $500,000. So Louis, despite having retired, has to go back, and he goes on this like reign of terror. He fights nearly every month for 1951 until he loses again to Rocky Marciano. It's quite this list here. He finishes up 1950 with a fight against Cesar Brion when he wins a unanimous decision. He'll have a fourth round TKO over Freddie Bashore. In January, Emilio Agramonte, unanimous decision. In February, that same month, like 2 weeks later, he TKOs Andy Walker in the 10th round. He takes March and April off, comes back in May as a rematch with Emilio Agramonte, and wins a unanimous decision. The following month in Madison Square Garden, he KOs Lee Savold. Another rematch with Cesar Brion in August that same month. He fights Jimmy Bivens. And then finally, our story comes to a close, as far as his boxing career goes, against the guy who we'll be discussing in our next chapter, Rocky Marciano. In which case, Rocky won the fight via TKO in the 8th round, October 26, 1951, in Madison Square Garden.
Which is just the hardest thing that Rocky ever had to do at that point, because Rocky's hero was Joe Louis. Rocky fought Joe only because he knew Joe needed the money, and that's the only way he was convinced to agree to fight Joe Louis, because he had no desire to hurt Joe Louis. He had no desire to take a punch, to punch his idol. It was one of those things where it was the hardest thing Rocky ever had to do, because of one: if I hit him and I hurt him, I'm hurting my idol. But if I don't fight him, I'm denying him this payday that's going to help him get out of the trouble that he's in right now. And it's a real dilemma for Rocky to have to deal with that. I couldn't imagine being in that situation and knowing what goes on. And Rocky, you know, goes in there, and he also knows if he takes it easy on him, it's the potential that his career is off the rails. And knocks Louis out, not only knocks him out, but knocks him out of the ring. And it's one of the saddest images you'll ever see, is the press row kind of holding Louis's head up after he's been knocked through the ropes by Rocky, because that's not how anybody wants to remember Joe Louis, you know. And even then, look at his comeback past Ezra Charles's defeat of him, which, by the way, is only the second loss he ever had. He wins 8 fights between Charles and Rocky. Only 3 of those were knockout wins. That's not Joe Louis at his best.
Right. The trouble with Joe Louis at this point has been the issue with the IRS, plus, you know, significant losses from failed businesses. This is one of those situations that's really sad. And it happens to a lot of celebrities where you think they're rich and famous, but really they're in a hole they never quite get out of. With the loss to Rocky Marciano, his boxing career was effectively dead. He would continue to tour on the exhibition circuit, with his last contest taking place on December 16, 1951 in Taiwan against Corporal Buford J. Cordova. And if that name sounds like a professional wrestler, hang on, let me get there. For income, Lewis became a professional wrestler. He made his wrestling debut in March 16th of 1956 in Washington, D.C. at the Uline Arena, defeating Cowboy Ricky Lee. After defeating Lee in a few matches, Lewis discovered he had a heart ailment and retired from wrestling competition. However, he continued as a wrestling referee until 1972.
There's a particularly sad event that happens during this time where Joe is brought in to be a referee at the Olympia in Detroit, which is the home of the Sheik's wrestling promotion. And he's brought in to be the special referee. And the promoter of the show, after the show, goes up to Joe and says to him, "Joe, I don't know how to tell you this, but the box office got raided by federal tax agents, and I don't have your purse." And you could see Joe's head just kind of sink and almost tear up at the point in time, because all he's trying to do is do these things to pay back what he owes, and they're just not even letting him live. And, you know, it's one thing to garnish wages, but what they did was they went after Joe Lewis. And for somebody who agreed to military service while he's in the prime of his career, for the things he did in terms of putting himself in that situation with Max Schmeling in Nazi Germany, to do everything that Joe Lewis did for this country, and to see him made victim by really stupid circumstances, is an embarrassment for America.
Jack Dempsey, who we talked about in our last show, actually served as an honorary chairman of a fund to assist Joe Lewis. And eventually, by the 1960s, I believe, they finally came to an agreement, him and the IRS, and he was allowed to live his life. He was able to a degree, capitalize on his celebrity status and his reputation as a good man. He had a, you know, greeter's job at Caesar's Palace for a bit. He went on quiz shows. He was also a golfer. In fact, it was a passion of his, and he played a historic role. He was a longtime devotee of the sport since being introduced to the game before the first Schmeling fight in 1936. In 1952, Lewis was invited to play as an amateur in the San Diego Open on a sponsor's exemption, becoming the first African-American to play a PGA Tour event. Initially, the PGA of America was reluctant to allow Lewis to enter the event, having a bylaw at the time limiting PGA membership to white folk. However, Lewis's celebrity status eventually pushed the PGA toward removing the bylaw, but the Caucasian-only clause in the PGA of America's constitution was not amended until November 1961. It paved the way for the first generation of African-American professional golfers such as Calvin Peet. Lewis himself financially supported the careers of several other early black professional golfers such as Bill Spiller, Ted Rhodes, Howard Wheeler, James Black, Clyde Martin, and Charlie Sifford. He was also instrumental in founding the First Tee, a charity helping underprivileged children become acquainted with the game of golf. His son, Joe Lewis Barrow Jr., currently oversees the organization as of this writing. In 2009, the PGA of America granted posthumous memberships to Ted Rhodes, John Shippen, and Bill Spiller, who were denied the opportunity to become PGA members during their professional careers. The PGA has also granted posthumously an honorary membership to Joe Lewis. Truly a great man and Hall of Famer, Joe Lewis. Final word from you, Pat.
Arguably the best fighter that's ever held the distinction of being the heavyweight champion of the world. An incredible sportsman, an incredible man. Somebody who finally got his due, the well overdue, in history. after he was gone from us, it's very difficult to try to summarize someone so so revolutionary in so few words as Joe. But up to this point, I think he's the greatest heavyweight champion we've seen that we've covered through this. And that'll be up for debate as we go through, obviously. But 11 years and 10 months, unbeaten, unchallenged, defending America, being this incredible fighting machine in the ring from a technical standpoint, where the things you see from him are just no wasted motion, everything with a purpose, this incredible fighting product. It's very hard to just summarize into words how important and how great he was. And watching his fights is just something special, whether you realize it or not. When you see them, when you see the clips and you see the highlights, you're watching artistry at work the same way you would watching, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright design a building or Mozart compose a symphony.
Jimmy Cannon, in responding to another person's characterization of Lewis as a credit to his race, stated, yes, Joe Lewis is a credit to his race, the human race. And that is where we'll leave our tale of boxing greats for the evening. Really enjoyed this episode, Pat. I've enjoyed getting to watch these old Joe Lewis fights. Very technical fighter, really the most technical fighter we've seen to date. And I'm curious to see where the road takes us next when we look at Rocky Marciano in a few weeks.
With a little bit of an interlude from Ezzard Charles and Jersey Joe Walcott.
Indeed. In the meantime, Pat and I actually just did a review together. We did Fuller House Season 5 Part 1. That's up in the archives. Tomorrow, if Pat can get out of work on time, we'll do ICW New York No Holds Barred. If not, I'll just be hanging out on my couch watching it anyway. Next week, we've got Doomsday Clock, Watchmen. If Pat's available, we'll do some 80s Kiss on the Metal Hammer of Doom.
I am available.
Pat, damn. You can also check out our Fight Club 2 review and our On Trial for Fight Club, which has been pretty well received. I've gotten some feedback on that. Are you working on the 12th? Are you going to watch NXT TakeOver Blackpool Live 2?
Let's take a look at the videotape.
All right.
Give me one moment. This is incredible because this is live, pending. I feel the heart-stopping curiosity happening as to whether or not this is a thing that I can do live. And I'm liking this anticipation building. We're waiting. We're looking. I'm pulling it up. And it's the 12th of this month.
Yes,
NXT
sir.
NXT Blackpool, Joe Coffey versus Walter for the NXT Championship.
Dun 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 dun.
That's a Sunday.
Yes, sir. In the middle of the day.
What time does that show begin?
The middle of the day. It's England.
Right, but middle of the day could mean a lot of things.
Goodness gracious. We'll have to... we're going to leave him in suspense, Pat, because I don't know exactly what time of the day it starts.
Well, if it's 3 p.m. or later, there's a very good chance I can watch it live.
Okay. In either case, we'll try to get Pat on to review once the event is over. NXT UK TakeOver Blackpool 2. And we'll definitely try to have him on for some more shows here. And we'll fit in this Rocky Marciano show sometime in the month of January. We don't want to wait too long. What else you got going on, Pat?
So we've got Kiss happening on the Metal Hammer of Doom, which is a show we've put off for quite a while. We were going to do it at Halloween, but that didn't work out. We had to flip the date again, and now we're finally going to do it as of January of 2020. Aside from that, we've got the Rocky Marciano episode dropping, which we're going to get to, and that's kind of all that's on the burner for now. For the Radulichin Broadcasting Network, anyway, I'll be recording with source material for the upcoming episode based around The Witcher, I will be mostly dropping stuff from the Henry Cavill series that I've finished, and well, you'll have to hear on that what I think about it.
And don't fret too much, because February 22nd, I'm going to make sure Pat's not working. He's going to be available. He's going to do it with whoever else I've got on that show, because it's Deontay Wilder versus Tyson Fury 2.
Oh, God.
I love it. All right.
Yeah, we're going to have to do that one.
Yes, we are, by Godfrey. All right, folks, thank you for joining us here on this long, strange trip through heavyweight boxing. We certainly appreciate you listening. We hope you enjoyed it. For Pat Mullen, the Punchy Pugilist, I'm your mandated reporter and, frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.
Welcome to Four Scores, a new podcast series hosted by Variety's John Burlingame. Four Scores will take listeners on a magical journey into the world of film and television composers, including Alan Silvestri, composer of The Avengers Endgame, Henry Jackman, composer of Wreck-It Ralph, and Pinar Toprak, composer of Captain Marvel. Composers will reveal to fans the challenges, rewards, and emotions that went into crafting these incredible scores. Listen wherever you hear your favorite podcasts.